Flashback, Iraq, 2003.
Gold, copper, oil, natural gas. It was the mining interests of the Guineans that had brought the paramilitary training to the security interests in the Oceanian country of New Guinea. The export of that economic model was spearheaded by a head-shrinking entrepreneurial tribesman named Ludestar, himself a turncoat to Indonesian oppression, who'd had the forethought to train his men in Arabic and English beginning in the early 1990s, splitting their days between language courses, subsistence farming, and unspeakably archaic ritual, up to and including, yes, the shrinking of human heads. What's up with that? No, really, what the fuck's up with that? Corporations that sought to protect their interests in the Arab world for a discount rate skipped over Blackwater and DynCorp and went straight to these snake and bird tribesmen. In the early 2000s, the five-sided Puzzle Palace had an independent contracting budget of $20 million a year.
Five-sided Puzzle Palace. The Pentagon.
That was separate and apart from the no-bid contracts that exceeded multiple billions. Halliburton's, KBR, etc. Ludestar sealed a couple of contracts quick, and so began the peregrination of tribal ops to contract in Iraq with Spearian flair, grass skirts, and bare feet. That's one thing to note. Meanwhile, back in Arizona, Scottsdale Senior Services offer a wide range of fitness, recreation, and leisure opportunities. This and its dry air made Scottsdale one of the preeminent retirement communities in America. It had come to the attention of the New Guinean intelligence apparatus, of Ludestar in particular, that a covert contract of operations was in the offing. Named, with a pinch of salt that paid homage to the Phoenix program of the early 1970s, and with Phoenix, the CIA sought to devastate the military infrastructure of the Viet Cong and South Vietnam through a series of targeted assassinations on its military commanders. The Scottsdale Project's origin at the Heritage Foundation was then supplemented with separate studies from Rand Corp and McKinsey & Company at the behest of the Rendon Group public relations firm. The project was adopted by NSA, taking note that in an era of globalization, would this unbranded senior generation bleed human progress and market development? Neutralizing pushback from the pharmaceutical lobby were those in the EPA's covert section, whose data concluded that with the extermination of high flatulence populations, so would go down ozone-depleting methane levels. An interesting note on this. It turns out that kangaroos expel no methane while providing lean and tasty meat. As a result, in the area of per capita killing, the elderly under the Scottsdale program were second to kangaroo among biped land mammal herds being culled. Bob had never clearly been able to sort out the balance of direct government implementations with shadow enterprises. It was not clear to Bob whether the White House was or was not in the direct reporting chain. His only certainty was that American taxpayer money was paid him in stacks of small denominations. Bimonthly, a Janet jet dropped in on a remote designated deck strip.
Janet jet. Janet is a de facto name for a small fleet of government aircraft. Janet is said to be an acronym for just another non-existent terminal.
White plane, red stringer, no tail number. The operatives were called to greet it, and as the air stairs met the men, they were descended by a functionary of the directorate, who handed each their stacks of singles like a mail call in a conflict zone. In that chance meeting with the tribesmen on Haifa Street in 2003 had kindred spiritude authorized his career. That which had been his organic patriotism sensed or had been led by in the popular ether. Now it's at the stage for Bob's seamless assimilation into sanctioned operational status. And with the crackety-crack-crackin' of long-barrel exchanges in purlieu, they sat together that night. The tribesmen and he, in a blast-blackened office space, its roof reduced to rubble by a car bomb blast the night before, leaving the stars and the Iraqi moon to illuminate their Turkish tea, freshly slaughtered chicken, and tawi, a red fruit indigenous to New Guinea. Bob's relationship with people, as his relationship to food, was independent of that which might be led by the palate. He'd long since lost touch with his defined appetite for either, but there was something in a people like these Guineans, whose first contact with the modern world and its corruption had only been a short half-century earlier, when missionaries became more apt communicators with cannibals, that Bob found particular joy in their company. It did occur to Bob that were the chickens not in such high supply, he might have found himself on the menu, instead of being recruited into a global mission of Merciful Boone. Quite simply, he felt understood. By the time the hookah was fired up to be shared, Bob found himself uniquely disarmed, and as a result began to share tales of his failed relationships with redheads. It was a rare burst of spontaneously relational behavior for Bob. Though he'd come to Baghdad with sewers and septic tanks on his mind, Bob would leave emboldened, not as an entrepreneur, but as a fresh recruit to the Scottsdale program. Despite having been intermittently successful in rather diverse businesses, his money management skills had always restricted him to cash-only transactions. He neither invested nor took lines of credit. As a traveler, he would often find that without access to his local bank, he was prone to under-budgeting of escapades. When he woke on the floor of the bombed-out office space in the morning, he found himself chimney-sweep filthy and abandoned by a pre-dawn redeployment of his Guinean brethren. Inside his passport, he found the mission codes they'd left behind for him. These were the digits he would from then on press into a burner phone when he sought a contract. He also found what was left in his ankle sock hideaway, a grand total of $10. Now he would have to make his way to Jordan by road, a 14-hour, $400 cab trip. He road-marched to Sodom City, later renamed Sodder City, where he was able to find a cell phone vendor from whom he could buy teleminutes. Bob called the Arab-accented point of contact he'd intended to meet with the night before.
Bob Hooney.
Honey. Bob Honey, Bob said.
Oh, yes, Mr. Hooney. Why you not come last night? I have many investors. We like septic tanks.
I ran into a little trouble, said Bob. I've actually got to get back to the...
Oh, Mr. Hooney, someone here wants to talk to you.
A ghetto black voice comes on the line.
Hooney, 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 we missed you last night, honey boy. We had bitches and chollywack all night long. My man Mustafa had prayer beads for you. Too bad you skated, homie. You know this is...
No, replied Bob.
The voice on the other end began to laugh uproariously.
It's Lude Star, man. I talk to my soldiers. You my boy now.
Yes, well, okay. But you don't sound like you're from New Guinea.
Lude Star countered.
I went to motherfucking Oxford, bitch. What you hearing is a motherfucking Oxford way of talking.
Oxford. Okay, said Bob. I actually have to get back to the United States. Can I talk to the other gentleman?
Lude Star laughed.
Just remember, you my boy. You have the codes.
As Lude Star trailed off mic, the first man's voice returned.
Mr. Hooney.
The conversation went on a bit, but Bob was ultimately able to get a $400 marker from the man at the Chalabi compound. He took it and hired a taxi to Jordan. Fuel shortages in the oil-rich country led cab drivers to spend entire days in pump station lines. But not water, the cabbie encountered by Bob. For one thing, water's fuel gauge was on the blink, so it was always a guessing game just how much fuel he had in the tank. Rather than linger in long lines, water would make the long trek through Anbar province, buying 1 liter at a time along the way from the black market boys of Fallujah and Ramadi. This was unsettling to Bob. But as it turned out, water had a fuel instinct, and the gauge on the blink though it was, he deposited Bob in one piece to the airport in Amman on the dot after 14 hours of drive time. It would not be for another 13 years when Helen Mayo would have her unfortunate encounter with an airship dropping from the sky. During Bob's absences from Woodview, she'd made a point of walking her chihuahua Nikki by Bob's house and encouraging Nikki to do his business there on Bob's lawn. Bob's overseas endeavors had allowed his Woodview lawn nearly a month of overgrowth. He'd arrived home sometime after midnight to a notice from the county clerk threatening penalties, went straight to his tool shed and pulled out his 1966 Briggs & Stratton winder start mower. He flipped the winding hinge and entertained its rotational clicks as he spun it. Then, hitting the electrical starter, it coughed and sputtered into action. As a boy, Bob had always loved his chores, and none better than the mechanized one provided by the mower. He was always meticulous to the wheel line. No better groundskeeper anywhere in the San Joaquin Valley. With mowing, Bob was the king of his own domain, and no domain ever had such a fine moment as that when the fragrance of fresh-cut grass filled its air. On this occasion, did he enjoy the mindless mission focus facilitated by following the streetlight-shadowed edges as they lit the lines of levels between what he'd mowed and would mow. Later, with the machine back safely in the shed, Bob took a shower and put himself to bed, clicked on the TV, and watched a whirl of news. American media coverage on the Middle East. In the battle within Bob's brain, media sources created a chaos of overload and a marketed, manipulated assault on retention, TMI. History books did the same. All Herodotus.
Herodotus, father of Greek historians, nicknamed the father of lies.
How was it possible for an American to calculate positive or negative impacts on the Middle East? One could either passively advocate medievalism and intellectual poverty, or choose intervention. There didn't seem much room to maneuver in the cradle of civilization, and our senses now systematically suppose savagery. Hence, Orientalism was perhaps a topic best suited for Orientals. Bob turned off the television and tried to close his eyes.
ABC, CBA, ABC, CBA.
God damn it. Insomnia was winning out. He figured after the zen of lawn mowing, he should never have polluted his brain with even a moment of the tube. But now that he'd done it, his power of peace was gone, evaporated. On second thought, insomnia was too disparaging a word as it applied to Bob's conundrum. The affliction of sleeplessness was one closer to a familiar truism. Daytimes made a practical demand upon most working people, but it was in the night's contentment of consensus isolation where Bob felt most a part of the bigger world. Though it was the wee hours, he wondered if he wasn't hearing the trickling cold cunt soup of his ex-wife's ice cream truck, whether it was an actual sound or an emotional echo. He made himself dream up a girl, only later embodied by Annie. When she sat naked in a chair, she didn't pose her breasts. It seemed she didn't pose anything. Her beauty was independent of her lovely face and body, and neither in need of a vanity to boost or question their shine. It swam out from her eyes in wonder and whimsy, her constant humor and skepticism of moral convention.
ABC, CBA, ABC, CBA.
And just as he felt he may drift, indeed he heard the approach of a vehicle outside, followed by the reflections of red and blue light strobing through his windows. He listened, heard the muted squawk of a police radio's approach, and with the all quiet, its surrender as it drove off. This was not a night for sleeping. Bob had never been a hunter of animals. In fact, he despised them. They and their easy kill technologies, their detachment from the kill, from the purpose, from their own primal existence and their petty thievery toward the noble beast. With one exception. Those who hunted wild boar with their own bodies and a dagger. Given his clear prerogative with the elderly, had he maintained that the intimacy with the mallet allowed him to violate with no shame? Bob got up into his pants and shirt, went out to his garage, opened the gun safe, and counted out $1,001 bills from a pile stacked high inside. He secured the safe and went back to his bedroom, where, amongst the clutter of his bedside drawer, he found a blank envelope. Wearing latex gloves, he inserted the $1,000 into the envelope, then moved to the kitchen where he wiped its glue strip wet with a damp sponge beside his kitchen sink, sealed it, stamped it similarly, and addressed it to the Woodview chapter of the ASPCA. He put his feet into his wallabies, walked out to his mailbox, put it inside, and raised the metal flag for pickup. Back inside the house, he put on a CD. Phil Oak sang, "I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy.
As though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal."
End of part one. Part two. It is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. J. Krishnamurti.
Organize your thoughts, my beautiful Bob Beam. You're losing the reader.
Station 5. Insect Homicide, 2016.
Sometimes Bob would hear Annie's voice in a whispered tone, even long before he'd met her.
I love the way you love me, Bob Beam. You know it, and I know it. The music of an ice cream truck sells sweetness, but its wares are cold and fattening.
She'd hit the nail on the head. Flash, a toddler with an old man's name, crawls under his young mother's hospital bed. Her head is shaven and marked, and he says he's hiding from the sun. Says his eyes are watering, not tearing. The TV is on, selling erotic perfume, while the blood of an aneurysm inside his mother's brain is bursting. Is this real life? Or Memorex? Advertising had been Bob's albatross. His burden least benign. Its sanctioning of ego and deceit. The greed of it. Its pollution of popular imagery. His sense of a malignant mass amnesia that had been welcomed into social acceptance like a creeper in the night. A country so marketed into madness. Manipulated and aghast. Now comes into vogue this ubiquitous shock and dismay while witnessing fellow citizens fall so witlessly to fascism. To Bob, this was clearly attributable to a forgetfulness of their youth's truths, a lapse to the basic complexity of each human's history of shame and isolation, its unending game of hide-and-seek with its own soul. Bob's ex-wife's ice cream vending business had become a sensation. She did interviews and had her picture in the local paper, bought herself and her lover a big fancy house in the upscale side of town, expanded her fleet, and therefore the territory of sound that Bob cannot escape, expanded too. In the nightmare, he was married to her still. From origins within the previous day when circus music had infused the air, and he'd been driving home from the market, about to enjoy a BLT, several insects had exploded on his windscreen. The nightmare began with memories sweet as nicotine. She tastes so good you roll her in your mouth. Then it kills you with cancer and life goes south. Through insect homicide, all these towns all seen before, the interstate abandoned while she neglects a fragile core. Cacophonous castration is such a fuckless bore. Insect homicide, I'm here. Not sure for what, for insect homicide. Then the ceiling is large and ornate. Doors creak over posh Austrian slate. She lies sleeping in the big plush bed. Last night's champagne eyes are this morning's red. Life full of strangers. Words like interviews and phoners. Life where what is sacred is only for the crowd. Life lived in circus music played aloud. Nothing is private nor special in the notoriety of frozen sweets. Decay is all around. Men are monsters. We all know that. So Bob sits and listens for the sound of her bat. And the religions of success that succeed only in the hatred of God.
Oh my, Bob Beam, drifting in such a terrible dream. It's Pappy's readers and not the ice cream vendor who need clarity and cream.
Bob jolted awake. It hadn't been a pleasant dream, but that he dreamt at all lent Bob to wonder if he might be seeking social connectivity. He hoped to have that impulse. He'd seen it in others, but it had always been elusive to him. As a purpose-driven soul, the soul of his purpose remained elusive too. He'd been close once to a fulfillment. Its formula perishing in a mathematical mindfuck, whilst endeavoring to make faces from fractals, in evidence of great spirits. And by these means, he'd come so close to rendering the visual equation, manifesting the face of God. For his efforts, he'd been ultimately rewarded with human bandwidth deficiencies in numerical retention, leaving portions of his prognosis
to simply perish from consciousness, like dreams unremembered. So as one does, he picked anew from what drew him at any given time. Bob's life, almost less human than dog, was a life lived as his own pet. He would take himself for walks, roam into adventure, and protect his master. One could always count on a dog to follow his nose. After some fluffy eggs and bacon, Bob would take his morning constitutional. Out on Sweet Dog Lane, he took to the street. The trees of treason and the worker bee ice cream trucks looked down, superintending the landscape of Woodview, viewing Bob's walk and broadcasting John Lennon, as trees sometimes do, in the unrevealed post-apocalyptic neighborhoods of the dwindling middle classes. As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. Bob stepped with his right and then his left. By giving you no time, instead of it all. He pulled his watch from his wrist and dropped it to the street. A neighbor boy rode by on a Schwinn and lifted it. Till the pain is so big, you feel nothing at all. The trees seemed to lose their color as he walked with his head up. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. His lace came undone and nearly tripped him despite his slow pace. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20-odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. As he turned down a perpendicular street, he locked eyes with his ex-wife cruising the next block in her ice cream truck. She paused at the intersection, glaring at Bob. Hers, a face that created and collected ignorance, arrogantly assimilating it as common knowledge. Then off she drove like the slow-motion unthawing of Kilimanjaro. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working-class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. An elderly neighbor sits centurion on his porch watching Bob with dread. Bob sees this. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. Now, in the topography of Woodview, can he see his ex-wife's continuing drive, navigating those higher elevations of town. There's room at the top, they're telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill, if you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A stray dog appears before Bob. It cuts into an alley and Bob feels pulled toward it as if by a magnet. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. A break in flux density and the dog skitters away.
Flux density, the magnitude of a magnetic, electric, or other flux passing through a unit area.
A spontaneous breeze picks up a page of morning news flying into Bob's face, wrapping it blind. Momentarily sightless, Bob takes a last few futilely following steps and is reminded of the last friend he'd ever made. That man in the middle of the sea.
Station 6. Religious Tourism, 2015.
Bob's pyrotechnic display at Isla Margarita, Venezuela had been a sensation and gained the attention of progressive governments throughout the region, who then clamored for his services. The winning bidder, Bolivia, was landlocked since it lost its coast to Chile during the War of the Pacific. But its determined Indian president had designated Lake Titicaca as a showplace for environmental studies. Bob would air freight his pyrotechnic barge and land 14,000 feet above sea level in La Paz, chew a little coca leaf to thin the blood, then truck his wares to the lake and the fireworks christening of the president's showplace. En route, his eyes followed wanted posters that pictured a Hasidic Jew from Brooklyn, New York, who had been imprisoned for allegedly laundering narco money. It was strange to see a man with a yarmulke and sidelocks on a South American wanted poster. Even stranger, posted roadside on the trees of a Bolivian jungle. Evidently, the fellow had escaped his prison and was now a wandering fugitive. After Bob once again impressed a president with fireworks,
he opted to make his way to the port town of Arica in northern Chile to sail the barge north back to California. With a Peruvian trucking company, he crossed to the sea. Armed with a tent, scuba dive kit, plenty of fuel, and an outboard, Bob would brave the seas and perhaps get in some choice diving. Only 2 miles off the Chilean shore, a maritime map identified a deep-water canyon. Bob anchored the barge to the canyon's shallow edge, some 75 feet below surface, then plunged into its crevasse. Bob found peace in the darkest depths and swam beneath bioluminescent fish. In the company of clusterwing snails, Abraleopsis squid, and the symbiotic bacteria of anglerfish, the ocean, it could be said, was Bob's only friend. In this place, where Bob offered the water no disturbance, more floating with the current than swimming, and where it took no disturbance to initiate luminescence, unlike at the surface, where all luminescence disturbed him and seemed itself born of disturbance. The only expectation of a man at that depth was to see, breathe, and monitor his own heart rate. There were no billboards, no televisions, no Instagram messages, no Annie, no ex-wife, not even the shame of a mallet. No, the sea was Neptune's land and Bob its most serene servant. With his hypoxic nitrous mix dwindling, it was time to make the slow ascent to the surface. As the chasm's diminishing darkness led to the aquiline shafts of sunlight, he rose, then broke the surface and took a big gasp of fresh air. Spent, he pulled his butt up onto the edge of the barge, facing out and flippers in the water, pulled off his mask and the top of his atmospheric dive suit, shut off his regulator, and released the clasps of his tanks. The weight off his back, Bob stared into the sun until a voice startled him. He turned to see a frantic, water-drenched Jew pointing Bob's own spear gun directly at Bob.
Who, Jew? Juvid Bolivian Intelligence, Juvid the Cartel Judiciary. Tell me now, who, Jew?
Jew speak, for who are you?
I'm Bob. Bob Honey. You American?
Barked the man. Bob nodded.
What were you doing down there?
Jew speak, for what were you doing down there?
Fish. Looking at fish. Floating around?
The man asks.
Swimming.
Well, yes, I guess so. I was swimming. Diving.
I need to get out of here, said the man.
Where did you come from?
I tunneled out of the prison, ran into the jungle, ran through the trees to the road, then caught the bus to the border, then to the beach. I never learned how to swim, but I made it, you sons of bitches. I dog-paddled, like a dog.
Bob's thought process inadvertently led to a private notion being shared aloud.
I feel like a dog sometimes, he said.
These words seemed to calm the man.
Where are you going, Bob?
Bob told him he'd be attempting to ride the barge all the way to California, stopping intermittently at choice scuba diving locations. The man lowered the spear gun with apologies and introduced himself.
I'm Fischl, Bob. Take me with you.
In the days navigating north through international waters, Fischl and Bob found a simpatico camaraderie. Fischl whined on about the wife that had left him during his long Bolivian imprisonment. While often taxed by the diatribes, Bob's brain read between the lines and found solidarity in Fischl's anguish. But more than that, Fischl was a creature stripped of all conditioning, religious and civil, suffering the inherent indignity of years as the lone American in Bolivia's worst prison, and doing so on the trumped-up charges made by corrupt officials had left him animalistic, almost primitive, qualities that fed into Bob's briefly burgeoning emotional wheelhouse. Perhaps, too, timing had played its role in Bob's recognition of friendly feelings. After all, Fischl was the first creature of contact in the sea, following his bioluminescent comrades from below. Though a non-swimmer, this dog-paddling Jew offered courage to the sea, and Bob and he were able to take shifts, sailing northward. This allowed each some tent time, their typically restless sleeps immunized by the lulling sea. By a week into their journey, and well into the international waters off Cabo San Lucas, Fischl napped away his Shabbat for Moses, as Bob, in his scuba gear, explored the ocean's depths and listened to his heart's proof of life. When he ascended, he felt a slight disturbance in the water. Looking up, at first he thought he was seeing the underbelly of a humpback whale, but in fact, after a bit more ascent, it became clear that the barge was being approached by the hull of a large vessel. Bob worried for Fischel that it might be pursuers, bounty hunters, Mexican mercenaries. As he surfaced, he encountered a strange phenomenon. The architecture of sound defining this place, which, at the time of his submergence, had been a diligence of seagull songs and wind-lapped water, now, upon his ascent, had its audio architecture been superseded by reverberative subwoofers and an up-tempo Mexican disco tune. And in this otherworldly wall of mercurial sound did Bob find Fischel, dirty dancing atop the barge with a mysterious, bikini-clad and gyrating señorita. The music came blasting from the yacht that had twinned with the barge. Fischel's viperesque dance partner, red lipstick smeared on her teeth, she held a shot of tequila above her head. Seeing Bob swim toward the barge, her smile widened, the streak of lipstick on her teeth magnified. This cobra began to hoot like an owl on meth. She slithered toward Bob, offering one hand to boost him up onto the barge while exclaiming, "If you don't drink our tequila, we'll throw you under the barge!" She laughed like a disingenuous reptilian jackal. With that, Bob took a splash of tequila into his face mask, licked his lips, and grimaced. Though feeling conspicuously out of place, he took the viper's hand and boarded the barge where he dropped his gear. Fischel said to him, "Bobby boy, grab yourself a señorita. It's fiesta time." So much for Shabbat. Standing at the yacht hull above the christened inscription, Plato Oplano, was a man of diminutive stature and imposing presence. "Amigo," he called out to Bob below. Bob smelled the waft of seasoned food. The man on the hull took note, pointing at the ladder the girl in the bikini had used to board the barge. "Come on board, amigos. We'll eat." In a palatial maritime dining cabin, Bob and Fischel found themselves enjoying a bounty of delicious Mexican cuisine. There were pretty girls dancing, servants serving, and machine-gun-toting bodyguards scanning the skies and the seas. They sat with their host of diminutive stature. They drank from a bottle of tequila, boasting the image of a winged woman resembling Fischel's dancing partner and branded with the name Tequila Mockingbird. A common interest shared at the table was that of tunnel technology. Bob had often thought to dig tunnels under his home, escapeways for the endlessly imaginable scenarios of need. As a boy, he had delighted in underground fort digging. Take days or weeks to dig 8 by 8 by 8 foot holes in a square. Worm slicing, rock cutting, water revealing holes. He had found an affinity with the underground, and on this basis alone, the yacht fiesta was a blissful, if not bewildering, occasion. Suddenly, automatic gunfire interrupted the easy feeling of the fete. One of the bodyguards had sighted a hovering drone and shot it out of the sky. It was time for the yacht's host to be on his way, and with apologies, parted from Bob and Fischel with a polite exchange of, "Adios, amigos." By the time Bob and Fischel were entering the San Diego harbor, cruising amid the pedal boaters of Balboa Park, they'd been tracked and tagged for a grilling. They were immediately boarded by officials of the United States Coast Guard, taken ashore, and grilled in separate rooms, each succumbing to a lengthy interrogation. Bob's passport in the hand of DHS agent Coco DeMille. DeMille sat tall in his seat, scanning Bob's passport through thick glasses and cross-referencing data on his laptop computer. He was a man slightly wall-eyed, the previous evening's bourbon permeating like hot breath from his skin. Sour, unpleasant, he began his interrogation.
"Tehran, 2005.
Leachfields for Septic Systems Symposium,"
Bob replied. "Cuba, 2003.
Bob coughed.
"Religious tourism."
"Managua, 2015.
"The Messiah volcano. I'd hoped to see it erupt. It didn't."
"Egypt, 2011, Israel, Istanbul, Abbottabad, Peshawar, Karachi, Beirut, Damascus, Uruguay, Liberia, Sierra Leone, South Sudan, Moscow. What's this one? Macau, 1994?
I'd forgotten about that trip, but I'm aware I went.
Let me ask you something, Mr. Honey, said DeMille. Are you aware, remotely aware, of the status of company kept between you and your friend on that yacht off Cabo San Lucas the day before yesterday?
Yes,
Bob told him.
We shared an interest in tunnels, boat tacos, and I think he liked tequila warmed by the sun. I will say, though, I don't know about you, but I'm not one to often be hurried. He seemed more willingly kinetic than me, or maybe it was just his patterned shirt.
DeMille removed his bottle glass specs, rubbed his eyes, and noticeably shifted tack. Let me try this one more time, said DeMille, hoping his unfocused eyes might lend to a less adulterated interpretation of this fellow Bob Honey before him, and perhaps bolster his own patience. He took a deep inhale, followed by a robust exhale. Can you tell me about Tripoli, September 2011?
Yes, I had been in Benghazi, an entrepreneurial seminar. In Tripoli, I wanted to take pictures. I never took pictures much before. I thought I might get a picture of big female bodyguards, but I didn't. Everybody was very busy at the time.
DeMille then asked pointedly, tell me about your trip to Syria in May of this year.
Actually, there they call it Syria.
The room hung silent. Bob then asked,
Agent DeMille?
Yes, Mr. Honey. Bob, beginning to struggle with DeMille's dermal halitosis.
In candor, can you tell me how long you think it would take to get the barge from San Diego to Catalina Island?
DeMille looked at Bob, whose expression, less blank than black hole, seized DeMille with a vex of vertigo. While Bob's areas of travel may have raised red flags, and the date of travel coincided coincidentally with events of note in those regions, it seemed that there was something about Bob, benign in his character, that afforded DeMille's surrender. Shaking his head, DeMille threw Bob's passport across the table to him and excused him with a blunt,
Get out!
As Bob approached the exit, DeMille asked him, You gonna wait for your friend? He's still in interrogation.
No, I don't think so. He'll understand. Spiritual people do.
Station 7. The Eustace Conway Syndrome.
Back in the alley of the dog, Bob peeled the wind-wrapped page of newspaper from his face, then remembered Fischl and how the sun and sea air upon his return to Woodview had taken some toll on Bob's uncared-for skin. He'd seen what he knew now to be the foreshadowing of his elderly years in the mirror, and that he'd wondered if his wrinkles may at some point accumulate unabsorbed Nivea cream. But it was a fleeting concern, knowing he could simply avoid the usage of cream. He remembered feeling the movement of the sea in his body for days after his return, sitting on the edge of his bed in those days weaving and watching television. Bad movies are the seasickness of misguided creative endeavor. When movie makers or actors forgo personal expression, it seemed to Bob the medium is left as one of irrelevant fantasies, where they add nothing to the world. What country without culture could be anything more than a shopping mall with a flag? Bob wondered how many artists had retained any sense of responsibility to their vocation versus those whose greed had been wrangled by Wilmette and vocations succumbed to careerism. He had no doubt, however, they were branding buoyantly, leaving Bob to yet another bout of that old sinking sensation. Breaking Bob's official nostalgia in the alley of the dog was the reappearance of the dog itself. Bob followed it, and it led him home, only for the dog to disappear once again. As Bob contemplated his navel, per the instructions of a book on meditation Annie had purchased for him in a New Age store,
Button, 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 belly, button,
he chanted. Then he heard the knock at the door. It was Spurley again. When Bob opened the door, Coltier was revealed standing on the stoop with two popsicles in a wrapping that boasted the image of Bob's ex-wife.
Popsicle?
Spurley asked.
No, thank you,
Bob replied. Good, said Spurley with a smile. More for me. Can I come in, Bob? In the living room again, they sat in their appointed positions. As Spurley sloppily slurped at one of the popsicles,
Bob couldn't help remembering similarly slopping sounds made by the woman who graced its package. Embraced as he was by his couch of comfort, he was feeling considerably creeped. "So, Bob," Spurley began, "I've been doing a lot of work."
"Yes,"
Bob nodded.
"I see.
Spoke to a buddy of mine down at the ASPCA. Do you have a checkbook, Bob? You should consider caution when mailing cash."
"Caution?"
Bob asked. "Yes, caution is something I'm guessing you and I relate to in different ways."
"Really?"
asked Bob. "Oh, mind, I'm by no means suggesting that you're without caution. Do you know what I mean, Bob?"
"No, Spurley, but so far I rarely have."
"Let's make today the day we change that. What do you say, Bob?" Bob thought and thought more. Then,
"Okay, Spurley, I'll try."
"Your ex-wife tells me you ended up as perfectly good friends in the aftermath of your marriage."
"Yes,"
said Bob.
"Advertising the adversarial is not good branding."
"Advertising the adversarial?" Spurley asked.
"Well, yes. Don't you find that people take opportunities to advertise themselves as being up in some way?"
"You're talking about the perception of high road, Bob."
"If that's the phrase,"
said Bob.
"I just wonder why people have to talk about certain things at all."
"Well, thinking along those lines, Bob, wouldn't offer a fellow like me much job security." Bob let out one of his guttural laughs. "Here's what I've got so far, Bob," Spurley announced. "I've got a lonely man, perhaps spurned by love, perhaps chronically depressed. He keeps odd hours, disappears for weeks and sometimes months at a time, makes no effort to meet or greet his neighbors, has, from what I can tell, virtually no social life at all, likes his BLTs toasted, has dabbled over the years in several businesses, and not only done quite well with them, but they've taken him around the world. And yet, Bob, you don't appear to me to be worldly at all. How am I doing?" Bob offered an expression that seemed to drift. It coincided with the vibration in his back pocket. He took out his cell phone and, masking the screen from Spurley, saw that Annie had just sent him a photograph of herself. When she did that, her portraits were diligently unassuming poses. Her expressions, as in the one sent this day, never seemed meant to pander toward Bob having one reaction or another, more as though she'd been caught off guard by the photographer. Curiously, Spurley asked, "What do you got there, Bob?"
"I don't want to be Eustace Conway'd."
"Hey, computer voice, whoever you are, who's Eustace Conway?"
"An American naturalist and loner who became a reality show star, leading to his arrest by the U.S. government."
"The mountain man?" Spurley asked.
"Yes, that's him," said Bob. "It seems like what it might be to be spied on."
"Spied on?" asked Spurley. "Knife collectors?"
"Yes, that's right, Spurley."
"Are you equating my article with a reality show?"
"Something like that, Spurley."
"You interested in spies, Bob?"
"I'm interested in spycraft, Spurley, but never been a diligent student of it, and when the world went cyber, I didn't, although I do keep a cell phone, that's true. Let's say I don't know much about cyber. Isn't everything and the burden of scrutiny moving very fast, Spurley?"
Spurley had never heard Bob string so many words together in a row. But before he could query further, Bob clicked on the television in the living room. The news was reporting on the shooting of 5 police officers in Dallas, Texas. There was no deliberation in the deification of police here. But just the day before, when police officers had shot 2 civilian black men to death, had judge, jury, and journalists pre-convicted them on racial rancor by Ruger. It occurred to Bob that the media had effectively encouraged the killing of cops, with that previous day's recording meant to buoy its own fraudulent negrocentrism and grandiose enlightenment. Today, they'd shifted gears. "What do you think about all that, Bob?" Spurley asked, referring to the television's report. "Do you think the police create the problem?" With his eyes fixed on the television, Bob said,
"I think people create the problem, Spurley. White men are afraid of black men. And I cannot speak for black men. I don't really know all the statistics, but it does seem that fear is a dangerous thing, and not the unique domain of police officers or black males.
The TV now reported that the perpetrator had been dispatched by police with C4 explosive by robotic proxy. Spurley saw that this too seemed to worry Bob and asked if that was so. Bob responded,
I worry, Spurley, when cause and effect are underestimated. Once subsumption architecture is introduced to popular culture, well, you know, it's never just one side that picks up the trend.
Subsumption architecture. In robotics, a bottom-up design that begins in simplified tasking, for instance, mobility, and is then built upon evolving to complex dynamics.
Bob turned abruptly to Spurley.
I don't want to be Eustace Conway with a reality show. I don't have a message to promote. You might as well write your ballad of a broken man without me.
Bob explained further that while he appreciated Spurley taking an interest in him, and that he had considered what an article might be like as an interesting proposition in this moment in his life, that he changed his mind and asked Spurley to leave once and for all. I'm sorry you feel that way, Bob, said Spurley. I've spent a lot of time and effort here. I think I've been patient with you. For some reason, I felt you were ready. Let me ask you one more thing before I go, if I must go. That cherry I left in the glass last time I saw you, did you keep it? Something red to rain over? But Bob had already walked to the door and opened it. He gave Spurley no response regarding the cherry, but stood silently awaiting Spurley's exit. When Spurley did exit, Bob closed the door behind him, locked it, and returned to his place center couch. Had Spurley deigned to add the word chub to his intuit of the word red, Bob surely would have made him meet his mallet. On television, ISIS, al-Nusra, Israel, Saudi, and the systemic degradation of the environment. Bob's irrational passion for dispassionate rationality was for him irreconcilable. The gap between that which we are accustomed to being told and attempt to interpret is in any place of cultural complexity and shifting political perspectives, a Rubik's Cube of historical brainwashing, petty crime, and swine sugar. He wondered if any notion of interculturalism might be foiled by the science of the brain, where one population wired its brain to read from left to right, another may take on the same task right to left, top to bottom, bottom to top, may prove inherent folly. Is it not so that the viewing of a face and its expression made or observed, that the same intended expression may be made or observed in totally contradictory ways depending on the wiring of any given culture? If the left corner of a mouth raised in one culture expresses friendliness or pleasure, might it express unfriendliness or displeasure in another? Are we truly able to understand each other, or doomed not to? Is culturalism explained by brain science, or foiled by it? Bob could not help but worry himself over these questions. He looked longingly at the pictures of Annie again. Her splendor of unselfconsciousness and wanton will, the accelerant enzymes her image infused in Bob, created a chemical cocktail he could only counter with condescension, a practice he restricted to the privacy of his own home. The tannerite target of Annie's charms, he stood to press play on his CD player. Phil Oakes's voice. Play the chords of love, my friend. Play the chords of pain. But if you want to keep your song, don't play the chords of fame.
Station 8.